Hello, everybody, and welcome to Remainders. For you out there who are not familiar, Remainders is the podcast that talks about the movies, old, new, current, crazy, weird, classic. We talk about all the movies that we love. Joining me every week is my co-host, who looks like he has gotten a beard trim since the last time I saw him. And he is my friend, but also a former employee at Suncoast Video, which is where we worked for the longest time. And it was the best job ever. And now we do this podcast together and it feels like old times. Patrick McIntyre is his name. Pat, why don't you say hello to the folks out there?
Hey, all you silent film listeners, lovers, here I am. Happy to have you here. And yes, shout out to Bo, who's been keeping this beard looking good lately. So,
oh, all right. Looks like you got some Chicago love. And yeah, you look good. You look very like kind of trimmed down. It was like a lot longer, right?
Oh, yeah. He took about half of it off this week. So it's definitely been a shift.
Well, very cool. You know, we decided to get together and do this episode because you had seen Babylon last time we talked and I had not. And so everyone out there who's listening, we wanted to talk about Babylon, but, you know, a cool way as I was watching the film to talk about it is maybe some similarities and differences between another film that I had seen that talks about the same time period, which is the 2011 film, The Artist, which I love very much. So both of these films I liked. I should just start off by saying that we wanted to do a bit of a mini episode to kind of compare and contrast. Pat, had you seen The Artist before, you know, I had mentioned doing this episode?
I saw it in the theater when it came out. It was at 2011, I think it was. Yeah. And I definitely remembered portions of it. I did not remember the ending of it. So rewatching it for this was great. For whatever reason, it just didn't stick in my mind. So it was definitely good to revisit. I definitely liked it quite a bit on this revisit. And so I was happy you kind of brought in the suggestion to kind of illuminate everybody, including myself, on a lot of the similarities, because I was very happy when I got your text about Babylon and you liking that. So I was sweating it for a minute because I was hoping you were going to dig it, but because this was a divisive one, I wasn't sure where you were going to land on it.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are mixed on this film. Obviously, I don't think it did as well as everybody wanted it to do at the box office. I did enjoy it for a lot of reasons, but I think more so because of what we're going to talk about today. You know, I really love Hollywood when they talk about themselves. It's a little bit of a meta thing, but obviously this has happened before, right? Singing in the Rain is one of the first films where they start talking about, you know, the technology and all the advancements that happened and sort of what that did to the industry, to their own industry. But another thing that happened, and I believe this book was made in the 60s, I don't quote me on that, but I just recently read it. It looks like the publishing was 1975. Nice. Kenneth Anger wrote this book, Hollywood Babylon. And I had read it and had heard about it. And I had mentioned last week that one of my favorite podcasts is You Must Remember This. And they talk a lot about the movies there. And they did actually like a breaking down of fact and fiction of Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon. But whether you believe what's written in here or not, really what he's doing is writing about the debauchery that was the silent film era and on into talkies and kind of these people that you hold in high regard, all these stars. It was kind of just exposing the seedy underbelly of all of the things that happened and the things that were swept under the rug, right? All the fixers that would come in and like if there was a death or a murder, they didn't want the public to know about it because it was bad for business. And so I think, to start out with that, have you ever read Hollywood Babylon?
No, I have not. And I was kind of familiar with it, but it wasn't really on my radar. I know you've talked about it a couple of times. Who's the author
of it? Kenneth Anger. He's a very interesting guy himself. Nice. But yeah, this was, like I said, kind of like really exposing some gritty parts of Hollywood.
Hell yeah. Love to hear it.
Yeah, totally. And I of course, everybody loves that stuff, right? Because we all hear about like the glitz and the glamour, but you want to hear about like, okay, give me some of the juice, give me some of the juicy stuff. Since then, a lot of these stories, I think, have been looked at as like fabricated or whatever. But either way, it kind of opened up the floodgates for people to start talk about Hollywood behaving badly. So when I watched Babylon, the film, last week. I went to Los Feliz 3 theater over here and it was great, great audience, great place to see it. You know, that's my theater. I know yours is the Music Box there in Chicago, but it was great. It was a great experience. It was long, but I know I kind of was along for the ride. But watching it, I saw this just total similarity to The Artist, but on a different level. And so I wrote a few things down that I wanted to discuss. And the first thing being, I think the biggest difference of The Artist and Babylon is that it's exploding the underbelly and debauchery of the time in a more focused lens, right? So that's like Babylon. I think it's like really, really, you know, showing things instead of you having to think about it. It really shows us the sex, the violence, the drugs, over the top. And I think it's over the top on purpose, you know? The Artist has more of like a classic Hollywood feel and focuses more on the time period, sort of how we remember that time period through time, sort of how you remember silent films, right? So one is almost like classier. The other one is just like, you know, really, really, really rough around the edges and kind of making it wildly crazy, because I think that's a good way to kind of flesh out the story of what it was like to just like go for the jugular in that sense. Did you find it to be that way?
Yeah, I mean, so The Artist is definitely putting silent Hollywood up on a pedestal a little bit more than Babylon. Yeah. I mean, Babylon's definitely still honoring the silent era, but like you're saying, it's like it's definitely trying to show the spectacle of what was going on in front of the camera, but as well as what was all the shit and shenanigans that were going on behind the camera. So I think, like you're saying, like it definitely matched that over the top kind of style, which again, like I love. It had a very fast, punchy direction. Like I think I mentioned, it kind of almost had like a Scorsese vibe to it. And that was definitely one of the reasons why it matched it so well with that story that they were trying to tell. But yeah, then rewatching The Artist earlier, it was a nice like love letter without all the tarnish to the silent era. And like I said,
a love letter without all the tarnish. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And like it does kind of go into a few of the dark themes, mm-hmm. But it certainly doesn't explicitly show any of the bullshit and damage that went on.
It's kind of like wrapped up in a nice bow for sure. And, right, yeah, definitely. You know, you can't say that Babylon is. I don't think any of those characters really got out unscathed in that film. And we can talk about that a little bit more.
Nobody gets out alive if they have to deal with Tobey Maguire. So, you
know. Yeah, that's a pretty cool part of the movie. I think that's kind of why I love that film. There was like some, you mentioned it's a little sloppy as far as the storytelling, and I would tend to agree with that. You know, could it have been cut down? Perhaps. Did I really think that the love story was well done? Not really. But I really liked the vignettes of the people and sort of the character studies, especially Brad Pitt, who I just thought was great. And that's another thing that I think they have similarities for, right? They have this aging kind of star in the lead role, Brad Pitt being the one in Babylon. And then his name is Jean Dujardin, I think is how I'm pronounced. And they're George. Both charismatic and well-loved, you know, silent film actors, but they're aging into talkies, and that's the problem. It's the problem in all three movies that we discussed, Singing in the Rain, The Artist, and Babylon, is that all of these actors sort of have an understanding of how to do their job until we have to actually speak on film.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely the first thing I noticed while rewatching The Artist, is the similarity between those two characters kind of losing their power. I thought, again, Brad Pitt was pretty perfect for that role, you know, because it was more of an ensemble. So his arc wasn't the only thing that was getting covered, which I think kind of added to it. It gave it a little bit more heft because it was, you know, being accompanied by Manny and Margot Robbie's story.
Yeah. Just a quick question. In the 60s in general, like we kind of know him in that role right now. Like, is Brad Pitt the Brad Pitt he was when he was in his 20s and 30s? I mean, I still think I would think everyone would agree he's legendary, but like he's aging out of certain roles at this point.
Yeah, and he's been pretty candid about his own personal struggles, being one of the largest stars in the world and kind of what that does to his personality. Like, I mean, he's been pretty candid about his personality doesn't really match being the biggest star in the world. And I think that's where he's been a little iffy on some stuff.
Yeah, just watching the Golden Globes last night. Oh, he was in the front row and everybody kept on talking about him. And it's like, yeah, I want to look Brad Pitt. He's sitting there smiling and he's playing the, he looked kind of fucking awesome. So
how were the Golden Globes? I did not watch them. I saw all three movies that won Best Picture I was pretty happy with. I saw that.
I got to say, honestly, the first time I've watched one of those shows that I actually enjoyed. I don't know what it was about them. I really, really liked it. And dude, the best part about it was Steven Spielberg winning for the Fablemans, and he goes up there and Tarantino is the one presenting him with the award, right?
So
already like, holy shit, Tarantino, Spielberg, same stage, these two giants, you know? And Spielberg, as he is taking the award, Tarantino whispers something to him. And you see Spielberg kind of just react a little bit and go up on stage and he says, I just have to address really quickly what Quentin said to me. He said, John Cassavetes would be very proud of you. And he said the reason was that he was a PA on John Cassavetes' film set, Spielberg was. And I didn't know that.
Oh, my God.
I was like, there's a lot of things that I loved about that scene because Tarantino is basically a genius and knows everything about film, would know that Spielberg was on that and has the right thing to say to him at the right time. You know, that affected him. And then also just thinking about Spielberg as a PA on a John Cassavetes, like the king of independent film. And you've got like the biggest blockbuster filmmaker of all time.
Yeah.
Being his PA. It's insane to me. I didn't know. Did you know that?
No, I did not. Yeah. I know he was, that was a director he definitely respected quite a bit, but yeah, I definitely didn't know. I've come across a couple different relations of like early work from famous directors and who they worked with. So I've definitely been digging a hole on that, and so I'm going to share a couple of those coming up.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Yeah. That's good then that I kind of caught that because I thought that was my favorite moment.
Yeah. That sounds great.
Yeah. It was enjoyable.
Love it. Yeah. So
I was gonna say, like, back to Babylon and the Artist, we do have these two characters in the male role that are very similar, right? So that's a very big similarity. Both of these films are set in the 1920s silent era, so we know that is the start of it. And then the challenge is that they're going to be moving to talking pictures, like we said, and that carries us through time to see how the landscape and the characters change with the technology and innovation. It's very similar in both films. That's very similar in Singing in the Rain. And then we have, you know, this up and coming newcomer, which is also very similar. However, the characters aren't similar. You have Pepe Miller in The Artist, who is this very charismatic, just happy-go-lucky commoner who can dance and is kind of looking for her breakout role. And she's also a fan of the lead character of George Valentin. And then also Nellie Leroy is her name. That's Margot Robbie's character in Babylon. And she plays as just like totally from the wrong side of town, gritty, rough around the edges, star who can cry on demand, who's amazing in the silent era, and she has what it takes. You know, the movie goes through this party scene and then shows like in 3 hours you need to be up and be on set, which I love because that's just kind of how this town is. It's like you work hard and play hard, you know? But both characters, they show promise and excitement for a new generation of stars in Hollywood. And like I said, the difference here is that Nellie is a star that can't escape her past and become the true star that she could be. When Pepe Miller in The Artist is the newcomer who just has it. She has it. She's fun, exciting. She loves film. And even though she comes in as a newcomer, she's always a true star. You just know she has it in her and she grows into that role as the film moves on.
Yeah, I mean, I love Margot Robbie's character and her performance in Babylon so much. That those early scenes with that first hour of them kind of breaking the film, breaking into it, and her kind of getting her first chance with the director, so fucking great. And then showing just how she can, like you said, cry on demand. It's such a, her performance is so great. And definitely one of my favorite parts of that movie.
For sure. She's insane. She's so good. And everybody knows it. The thing about her is I feel like it's just like every movie I fucking see is with Margot Robbie. You know what I mean? Like these days, it's like every lead character in any big movie, they cast her. And I'm kind of getting a little like, give someone else a try, you know, give someone else a shot. But there's no doubt she's amazing.
Margot fatigue. You know what I rewatched not that long ago was I, Tonya.
Okay. That's her best role.
Oh, fantastic. Because that movie fucking rules, dude. It is so great, largely because of her, but just like what the tone they go with, covering like a stupid crime. It matches her performance so well.
Love I it. Believe she produced that too. I think she had a big role in that other than just acting. And yeah, she's amazing in that. My girlfriend and I were just talking about that. Like that's the role Robbie did that we were just both like, okay, she's a star, you know, she's a legend.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's like based on a stupid crime. You're like, kind of like, damn, Margot Robbie's going to be in this film about like Tonya Harding, you know, and the whacking of.
That one had, similar to like I was saying, like a very Scorsese influence with like Goodfellas, but since Goodfellas and Casino were like kind of more serious criminals, this was a bunch of morons trying to commit a crime, and so that's the tone that they go with it. So, and that's why it's such a great comedy. I fucking love
it. They also did a good job of kind of being true to like showing why Tonya Harding had this rough exterior and
true. Just opening it with like based on completely contradictory interviews by everybody.
Nobody's telling you the real truth.
Right.
I think that she's great, and there's no doubt about that. Definitely adds to the Babylon being a great film.
And Pepe. Man, what a good character Pepe is. I mean, that's what's so great about like the art, because it is. If you haven't seen it, like it is majority a silent film, and these performances are pretty unlike anything in most movies we've been talking about, because it's done entirely through their facial expressions. They're basically doing the silent films that they're honoring. So,
right, and that's the difference too, right? It's because in Babylon you actually have speaking throughout the whole thing, even though it's about movies that you don't talk in, and you can actually hear the characters talk and everything like that. Like the movie is not supposed to be set in like the artist where you actually are silent the whole time, and you have to rely on the cards and everything. Right, and you're right. Like Pepe Miller and the facial expressions and everybody here is so good. John Goodman in this film is awesome. But
it's basically the only line that you hear in the whole
it's
film.
Perfect. Right?
Yeah. Love it.
So good. They both show the conflicts that arise when talkies are introduced. And, you know, we know that is going to be the biggest problem. And Babylon shows us like on-set entanglements and stars who can't quite deliver the lines eloquently. So we go through all of that. Like, you know, it's got to be really quiet on set. You can't hear the camera, you know. So the guy's stuck in his box and he ends up dying, right? Spoiler alert. But, there's a lot of things that have to happen different just production wise. A lot of times I think in Babylon, it's also like for people in Hollywood, it's like insider stuff in there, because, you know, the sun going down and trying to get the shot at the right time, like, and all of the
love that
on set. Yeah. Like it's so what it's like, you know, and those are great scenes, but
it's just, it just shows a type of filmmaking that probably rarely ever happens anymore, because like you can always kind of doctor and do something to get the right type of sunset. Obviously you could be on set on location filming, but like that entire day in Babylon, the opening scene was based on capturing that one shot at that time of day with the sunset, and the whole scene would have been useless if they didn't get it in time.
Totally. That's such a great scene too. Like the only camera that's left to rent. And then they're talking about like the difference between the two. He's like, I don't care. I just like, give me a camera, like whatever I can to shoot this, you know? But yeah, like the days of mugging for the camera are over, and the productions have become intensified and exceedingly more difficult. And there's a lot of struggles between different people in the film because of that. The artist shows how the lead character refuses to talk. And, you know, the cool thing about the artist, and again, hopefully this is not a spoiler alert, but we don't know really why, you know, why won't George Valentin just talk? Like it could, you know, he's just really adamant about, I'm not going to talk on film. But what you don't know until the end of the film is that he's French. He would never be able to talk on film because he's French. He has that accent and he doesn't really probably know English well. And so it's just impossible. It's like Bela Lugosi and why he was so typecast, because his voice is just not eloquent enough to carry any kind of role other than Dracula from Transylvania, you know?
Yeah, it was definitely the crux of and feeling the most for his character in The Artist. You could see in that, like, everything that he wanted, he was just holding back because he didn't feel like he could. And in reality, probably wouldn't have been able to unless it went the way it did with him transitioning into more dancing roles.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, so we know that this is like where it's kind of the beginning of the end for George Valentin, because if he's not going to be able to talk, he thinks it's a fad. He's going to do his own movie. He's going to produce it himself. And he obviously goes bankrupt. Another thing is, like, common in both of these films is suicide, right? We're going to the time of the Great Depression. We're going to a time when people, like, were on the tippy top and now they can't deal because they're obsolete, you know? They're nothing anymore, and they think their lives are nothing, which is like a whole nother conversation. And we see the lead characters both struggle with taking their own lives. One of them actually does, right?
Yeah. Spoilers, definitely. I was pretty taken aback by both. Like, I didn't realize in The Artist, I, for whatever reason, I just didn't remember the too much of the ending. So rewatching this time, it was pretty surprising that his character went that way. And then in Babylon, that definitely caught me off guard as well. So,
yeah, I love the way that they shot that in Babylon. I don't know if we really should give that away too much, but
I mean, we already have. So we're saying spoilers, and we'll put spoilers in the notes. So,
okay, good. Yeah, I just don't want people to hate us, but yeah. That scene is really shot beautifully, where it's just like you're peeking in through the door to kind of see like what it's like. And even what Brad Pitt says before he goes up to end his life, you know, he's telling, it's your turn now, kid, you know? And
yeah, he gives what's the largest tip you've ever gotten? And like, who gave you the largest tip, or how much was it? Yeah, from you. So he gives it to him and says, it's on you now, kid. That line was definitely stuck with me.
Yeah. And before we move on to that, I just want to talk quickly about the scene of the Hedda Hopper, Luella Parsons role, played by Jean Smart. That's maybe my favorite character and my favorite scene, at least, when she talks to Brad Pitt, and she's explaining that your time is just up. You might not think it is, but it is. And you should really feel lucky because you're going to live forever. People all the way down the line are going to be watching these films, and you're going to be a ghost in these, you know. And it was so beautifully written, and it was so true. Look at us talking about the movie. Last week we covered Metropolis, you know, and we're talking about a film that's almost 100 years old, and these are ghosts on the screen, but they live forever through cinema, you know. And that's a beautiful thing.
Brigitte from Metropolis definitely deserves to be honored still today. So Jean Smart, she was great in it. I mean, was she based on, you think, like a real reporter, or do you think it was like a composite of?
Yeah, so what I believe is that she was based on, like I was saying, Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper, who were both like, you know, gossip columns.
Okay.
I wrote something about it. Let me see if I can find it.
Because it was just, I mean, kind of side tangent. I mean, a movie, it's not exactly about the same era, but similar. It was Hail Caesar.
From
the Coen Brothers, right? Which I absolutely love that movie. But Tilda Swinton, she plays like twin dueling gossip columnists who I believe were based on like that exact type of dynamic, twin columnists who were reporting on the stars in the 50s. And Tilda Swinton just nails it in that movie. Obviously, she doesn't have the empathy or is as kind to the stars as Jean Smart is in this one, but definitely represents the era.
Well, and I think the thing is that it's different in this film. Like, usually when you think of Hedda Hopper or Luella Parsons or different gossip columnists, even like TMZ right now, TMZ is a little different now because it's become like bigger than any Hollywood stuff almost. But back in the day when they had these like, you know, gossip rags and stuff, it could ruin somebody's career, right? Like if they wrote the wrong thing about it. So a lot of times, you know, the stars would want to play nice with them and everything. But the role of Jean Smart in Babylon is almost like flipped, because you know that like they want her to write good things about her, but it's mostly like she's the one telling the truth. She's telling Brad Pitt the truth, even though it's something he doesn't want to hear. He knows it, and she's almost telling him like you know, you've got it good. So she's almost like the only voice of reason, which is crazy. The gossip columnist would be that role, you know?
Right, right. I did kind of have that thought that this person who has kind of has everything summed up more rationally than everybody else is the gossip journalist, in quotes.
Totally. Another thing that I was seeing is that the idea of, let me just look here. Yeah, so the artists in Singing in the Rain all use choreography and dance as a way of uniting the characters. Mm. Dance is a big one in The Artist, because as we find out, okay, if you can't talk, there is something we can do together. And eventually in the film, Pepe Miller and George Valentin team up to do this dance number. And that's like the beautiful way that they like are able to come together and then put a nice bow on this, right? Singing in the Rain is the same way. They all know how to dance, right? And like there's these amazing segments with them, especially Make 'em Laugh, which is one of my favorites in Singing in the Rain. But they all use choreography and dance as a way of uniting the characters. But Babylon doesn't rely on dance so much. It does show folks enjoying themselves quite a bit and at these Hollywood parties and there's dancing and stuff. But the debauchery is amped up to really show the work hard and play hard aesthetic in LA. And there's not really much dancing in that film. So that's a difference between the two films as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think maybe you have mentioned it, but like that first like half hour was set at like the party at the mansion.
Yeah.
I mean.
In Babylon, you mean?
Yeah, in Babylon. The first half hour, 45 minutes, they have like this extended party at a mansion with all the movie stars and all the shit that's going on. I mean, it definitely feels like some of those Coke scenes in Wolf of Wall Street when they're at the office has that vibe for sure. And it definitely like it captures the behind the scene dancing. I mean, the dancing that you show on Singing in the Rain or at the end of the movie, it's like that's the celebration of life through this. But then this is maybe like what some of the parties actually looked like behind the scenes. And it was still capturing that celebration of life, even though it ended in bullshit for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's really good. I like that, like a lot of like behind the scenes dancing, you know, like it's pretty good. But I don't think that the subject matter of like the debauchery is that new right now. I feel like it's actually more than anything in this time period has been talked about more, like through the podcast or even I think Ryan Murphy had a show, I know he did, on Netflix called Hollywood, I think it was called. But anyway, talked about like sort of the underbelly and different things that were happening that you didn't know about. So it's not like this is like all brand new. And again, it's just being talked about in different ways. Even in Singing in the Rain is talking about like a lot of things that are happening, but it never really went into the debauchery until like this book was made. And then I think it was kind of like everyone opened the doors to talk about Hollywood behaving badly, right?
Right, right, right. I mean, you gotta, as the movie shows, so you gotta rely on the behind the scenes journalists to get everything right.
Right, totally. Yeah. You know, the other thing about this is that I noticed Babylon focuses on the rise of not only a new star, but also the rise of an immigrant, right? Manny, and an immigrant in Hollywood. I mean, the film opens on him and, you know, him sort of doing this really big grunt work to get the party going, with having to get an elephant up the hill, which is insane.
I mean, Manny is definitely the main character of Babylon, right. Which is surprising because, I mean, I read something about that actor. He had only been in like one or two previous films. And so like for this to be like one of his first productions, like in front of the camera, because I think he was, and probably still is, like kind of more interested in writing and directing. Mm. It just kind of really mirrors his ascension in Hollywood, the character, as well as his own life is as an actor now, because he's basically acting opposite Margot Robbie and Brad Pitt in one of his first movies. So
yeah, and a Damien Chazelle film. that follows.
He obviously saw something in him that didn't that spoke with him, because again, like, he really didn't have too much on his IMDb.
Well, I think the thing about Manny that we needed to see is that he's an innocent, right? He starts out as an innocent and passionate man who, you know, wants to have his dreams in Hollywood fulfilled. He just like anybody else, you know. But he also has this passion for Margot Robbie right in the beginning, right? This new starlet gets in his way. She's always getting into trouble, and he's always the one who has to kind of bail her out. He ultimately tries to save the woman who never really wanted to be saved. You know, the woman that couldn't exercise her past and live comfortably in her future as a star. And even though that's always what she believed she was, she just kind of couldn't get out of her own way, which cost Manny really this great career that was blossoming, right?
Yeah, I mean, I love that early scene when they're doing coke in the side room, when they're just professing their love of film and being their true selves with it. It's so great. Definitely set the tone for what those characters are going in, and kind of the movie itself as well. Like, because all that was going on is like the quiet, that's the quiet coke room, basically, while the rest of the party was going on.
Yeah, they kind of, and like, of course, he gets her into the party, right? Like, he kind of like, says he knows who she is. So they're kind of like, in the beginning, they're already helping each other out. And in the beginning of the film, it's pretty promising. At the end, it's kind of like a one-way street where she just needs to be bailed out of everything. And he's doing the best he can, but she just like, she can't get on board, you know? And I think the thing, I don't know if you found it to be really funny. I think Babylon was supposed to be pretty funny in times. Obviously, the artist is super funny. So I think comedy is used in both films to add excitement and fun of making movies. But it also helps to develop the characters, like Brad Pitt falling off the roof and into the pool, which is like one of the coolest scenes in Babylon. And then George Valentin and his relationship with his dog, like, is just like so endearing and so fun. There's a lot that like of those kind of things that are built into the characters that make the audience sort of like love them a little bit more.
Oh, the dog, great performance in The Artist. Definitely it captures that silent film era tone and definitely adds to his character quite a bit. It's so good.
Yeah, I loved it. It's kind of like anytime you have like a good, like kind of like animal who like the audience, of course, falls in love with. And then it's like doing tricks the whole time and, you know, being obedient to the master, meaning George Valentin. Like, you can't help but love it. Like, he saves them from the fire, like, you know, awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell sincere performance by the dog. Loved it.
Yeah, you know, I think another thing that happened by being smart and creative about using sound or not using sound, I think it was kind of like I was looking for, like, I almost feel like Babylon had that impact that I wanted, like I got from the end of Cinema Paradiso. When he's watching all those film clips and you're just fucking crying, like, nobody watches that film and doesn't cry at that part. I kind of wanted it to be like that for Babylon, but I just think like the misses that happen, like, for instance, like, I don't think Margot Robbie was like that redeemable and like that lovable at all. Like, so like, you didn't really like care too much that, and I don't think they had that great chemistry. So everything that kind of led up to that didn't make me love that very end scene where they're like going through like, you know, cinema history, right?
Yeah, I mean, the relationship, it was pretty one-sided, obviously. And so it definitely, that's the kind of stuff that kind of stuck with me the most, because it kind of reminded me of, like, you know, relationships going on all the time that are just one-sided, and it definitely kind of got into that with this one.
Yeah, you know, because like, in The Artist, the idea of like, anytime sound comes into play, like, that great scene where George Valentin like is like having a dream, but the feather like is, you know, makes the sound like a bomb went off. And you actually hear the sound at that point. Like, he's hearing like, you know, the cup sit down. And it's so crazy. It's kind of like, because there's no sound in it at all, the moment there are sound, it's very important. And it makes the audience really pay attention and be focused on it. And that's especially significant at the end when you hear him finally talk and he's French and you're like, oh my God, like, that's the twist. That's like the Shyamalan twist, right? Like, this guy's French. He can't talk.
I love that scene, just like 45 minutes into The Artist, when he's in his dressing room and he starts hearing the movement of stuff. And as the audience, like, that's the first thing you're hearing from the film itself, other than the music. That one stuck with me quite a bit, because I mean, that's the one where it gets meta and kind of offers, it's going to tell you the story in a little bit different way than just a traditional silent film.
And like you said earlier, like, it was pretty scary too, you know, like the women like kind of cackling down, and you're like, oh my God, is this like, it almost felt like kind of like in Pee-wee's, you know, like when they're on set, it's like, that's like a really scary moment in Pee-wee's Big Adventure for me. Like everything that's on the studio lot. And like, it felt like that, like everything was closing in on him and the sound was like scary. And I don't know if you related to that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and also I was actually just thinking meta, like, if he actually was living in a silent film and then he started hearing that, he would be having a psychotic breakdown. He'd be definitely be freaking out a lot more than he was.
True. Yeah, you're right. And it plays with sound really nicely. The artist was very creative that way. That's what I wanted to keep this a short episode, but I definitely wanted to kind of like show the difference between these two films, mainly because they're about the same time period, but they're done differently. And both are good. Both films are great. I mean, I definitely think I've always like loved The Artist the most. My main gripe with The Artist is that it uses the theme to Vertigo during the entire end of the film. And my biggest problem with that is that like everybody fucking loves Vertigo. Everybody knows Vertigo. That's my favorite film. It's like, I can't stop thinking about Vertigo when I hear that, you know? Like.
I saw Kim Novak had a pretty big problem with that when that happened.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just when I was just reading the Wikipedia page earlier today, she had a pretty big issue when they used that came out. So I don't know. I don't know any other details, but she was definitely not happy about it.
Well, just as an audience member, it took me out because I'm, you know, a fan of Vertigo. So I'm trying to like follow the story, which is a very poignant and exciting, not exciting, but a very important part to the movie of what's happening in that scene. And it's the entire like 20 minutes of the end of the film is the theme to Vertigo. Like kind of makes sense.
I mean, it's a good song, so.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Bernard Herrmann.
Can't argue with that.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the Easter eggs that I found in the film. I don't know if you noticed a few things. I know we've talked about it before that sometimes maybe I'm a little bit.
I've read them and I did definitely not notice any of them, but they all make sense. So I appreciate you illuminating me on them quite a bit. So
there may be like a lot more. Like that's the thing is like, I don't know if you caught anything. And I'm sure like if you're out there and you catch other things, like I was talking a lot about, I had just read this. So I knew a few of the Easter eggs based on like,
right,
you know, folklore of like some things, but I also kind of like things like Jennifer Grant, Cary Grant's daughter, being in this film. I was like, no doubt, right? When I saw, I was like, that's Cary Grant's daughter, and like that was obviously done.
What did you think of that scene? So in Babylon, when they go to there's a scene where they have to go to like basically the producers, which apparently is based on William Randolph Hearst, that character going to their party. To appease all the people with money, essentially. And
well, we saw that in Mank too, didn't we?
Say it again.
We saw that in Mank as well, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right. But what did you think of this one in Babylon with Margot Robbie?
What I think it does is it just like follows with the theme of like the debauchery, right? Like if they're gonna, part of the problem with a lot of the people that came and that were silent movie stars is that they didn't have good speaking voices, and the problem is they may be great actors and they probably could transition. For instance, Joan Crawford is one of the actresses who was able to transfer into talkies. She had a great speaking voice and it was good, but obviously the character of Nellie LeRoy has this sort of New York accent or maybe a New Jersey accent, I can't remember, and that's not great for film, and there's not that sort of dialect that all of those old actors had. And so when she goes to the party and she's trying to like, you know, hold her own and they're really trying to shape her and she can't, you know, she can't fucking take it. She's going crazy inside, but she's doing her best. That when she becomes unhinged, it's amazing, you know?
I mean, it almost looks like an SNL skit by the end with all the, with all the puking going on. So
yeah, it's like, so like, well, you know, if you guys want this, like, this is who right. I am.
To yeah, yeah. So good. Well, and she pulls it off great. It was just so like ridiculously over the top and comical in almost a childish way, and yet it still kind of like matched it pretty well. So,
and I think what you just said about that over the top is kind of like the theme that I got out of this whole film the whole time through. Like if they're going to show boobs, they're going to show boobs like to the 10th degree. Like everyone's going to have their top off. They're going to show, like, there's like one scene where like they show like something like at that beginning party, like all of it's pretty outlandish, you know? And I don't know. I think that that's the point of the film, right? I think that like Margot Robbie's character to go crazy and to like throw up all over the place is like, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it over the top. Yeah. Another thing that I caught from the film is like in Hollywood Babylon's, there's a story about supposedly Clara Bow had slept with the entire USC football team. Like that's what he alleges in this, right? Now, I'm sure that's not true. Clara Bow is not around anymore to tell us it's not true, but I think it's been debunked since this book came out. But they use it for sure in Babylon when you see Nellie LaRoy show up with an entire football team to a party, right?
I know, I was cracking up. Obviously, I didn't get the joke when I saw the movie, but I was cracking up when I saw you wrote that. So,
yeah, I mean, like, it's based on a, you know, folklore of Clara Bow. Hollywood Babylon also discusses Fatty Arbuckle trial. Do you know anything about that?
No. I know Fatty Arbuckle for sure, but definitely don't know what trial is going on.
Yeah, and you know, this makes sense too, because a lot of times you talk about like liking the actors but not really knowing much about their personal lives. Mm. And so like that's what this book is all about. It's like they're them behaving badly in their personal lives and all that kind of stuff. I know you kind of stay out of the drama, but Fatty Arbuckle went to trial for his involvement in the death of an actress named Virginia Rappe. Mm. And they seem to be alluding to that in the beginning of Babylon a little bit when the woman overdoses with the overweight man who like likes to get peed on. I believe he's kind of like the Fatty Arbuckle character that they're using in the beginning.
I mean, was there anything about Fatty having a pee fetish?
No, but okay. There is things about like bottles being like shoved up like people's private parts and stuff like that. Like that was part of the trial. And there's for sure stuff like that happening at that party.
Yeah, man, they went hard in the 20s. No doubt about that.
So I think that like, again, I think that the filmmakers are using some of those stories. They're not like saying this is exactly that, but they're
using. Oh yeah, it's just they're alluding to a lot of the shit that the folklore, like you're saying, is going on. And so it's I don't know if anybody's estate is going to take issue with any of that, but there's certainly nothing over the top that's overtly naming anybody or anything that I know of.
Right. I mean, we're talking about a film 100 years ago too. You know, it's like, I don't know, maybe like. Obviously, it's Hollywood making a film about Hollywood, which is, I don't know, you know, it's a little dicey, but it's a different time.
Hollywood loves making films about it. I mean, that's why The Artist did so well. I mean, it won everything back then. It won Best Picture. He won Best Actor for it, right? I mean, Hollywood definitely loves movies that honor itself, for sure.
And you know he was in Wolf of Wall Street as well, right?
The guy who played George?
Yeah.
Oh my God, really?
So you know, like,
I know who he is. He was the contact, the French contact for laundering the money, right?
Yes, exactly.
That's okay. No. I did not realize that until you just pointed that out. But when you said,
well, I'm glad I said it, because yeah, like I thought you would have totally put that together since you love Wolf. You know,
I mentioned it last week. I definitely noticed Rugrat from Wolf of Wall Street. It was in Babylon. He's the assistant PA at the beginning.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. He's so funny in it, but all right. Great. Couple, even more Wolf of Wall Street references. Love it.
And like I said, there's probably a ton of other like Hollywood Babylon references and stuff. These are just the ones that I noticed as I watched it. Again, this is a long film. So anybody out there who's wanting to watch Hollywood or wanting to watch Babylon, it's a really long one, but they seem to like had made the character of Lady Faye as like a nod to Anna May Wong, who was the first Asian American Hollywood movie star. Had you known anything about her before the film?
No. Yeah.
Yeah. And she has that great singing part at the beginning, right?
Oh, so good. Yeah.
And also a little bit of like a nod to Marlene Dietrich, I think, there, which is, you know, Marlene Dietrich had worn the like top hat and the suit and everything. And since that time, it was kind of like, that was like the first kind of like mention of lesbianism in film. I think they played with a lot.
I mean, yeah, that's always been having to be coded for so many years in different types of characters and in horror and just whatnot, yeah. And never could be overt. And so like looking back, like from film historian kind of perspective, there's so much of it there, but it was just had to be like subtext and never text. So
yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's funny when you go back on some of these movies and you're like, oh yeah, that's for sure. It was like Anthony Perkins was for sure written as like, you know, possibly a homosexual character, but it wasn't over the top and they didn't go out and just say that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't even show, you know, like beds in the or a toilet in the scene, so they were definitely weren't showing anything like that. So
I'll never forget watching the version of Psycho with Gus Van Sant had made, and you know, they're showing like the eye thing where he's looking through the people, and like they like alluded that he was masturbating, you know, because you could hear the sound. Oh, it's yeah. Like, but that's probably like I think what Hitchcock was doing in that film, but you couldn't hear the sound, he wasn't doing the sound effects and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Where do you stand on that remake, by the way?
I think it was fine. I mean, okay. You know, did it need to be remade? Probably not. I do love Gus Van Sant, though, for sure. Like My Own Private Idaho is one of my favorite of his.
Nice.
A beautiful movie. We should cover that one day, for sure.
Right on. Yeah. Yeah, I just remember seeing the remake pretty close to, like, that was probably.
Yeah, what did you think? I mean, it was supposed to be
shot. I haven't seen it since it first came out, but I remember that was, like, pretty close to when I saw the original. So like I saw the original and the remake probably within like 6 months or a year when it was in like 99 or something like that. So
I totally remember the tagline of that too when it came out. It was check in, relax, take a shower. Awesome. But yeah, recently it's funny, we went and saw Psycho at the Cinespia driving out here, and my girlfriend and I were like, yeah, let's go see Psycho and everything, and we're watching it, and like halfway through, like, you know, it's that scene where I'm like holding her hand really hard because I know it's like coming or whatever, and she was like, and I'm watching her face and I'm like, you've seen this film before, right? And she's like, never. And I was like, oh my god, you're seeing Psycho for the first fucking time. It was amazing.
Oh, that's just adding to your experience as well, then. I love it. That must be great at a drive-in. I've definitely never seen that at a drive-in. So
in the park, you know, in Griffith Park over here in California. It's great. That's the other thing, is like watching Babylon in Los Feliz, you know, in LA. Like, I don't know, there's something special about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's like watching Thief here at the Music Box in Chicago. So
yeah, we're going to watch any film, or we're going to watch Razorback in Australia, you know. Oh,
well, now you're just talking about you know, life goals, so we'll just keep that going for sure.
I don't want to be talking about all your hopes and dreams, you know, your bucket list moments and films that you want to see elsewhere, but yeah.
Oh no, talk them away. They're there for a reason. So
well, that's all I got for these two films, and I just love the fact that it's kind of similar, you know. There was a lot of similar, I don't know, I just kept thinking about it the whole time I was watching Babylon. I was like, this just feels so much like The Artist. Obviously different, but a lot of similarities too. And then also to Singing in the Rain. So thanks for getting together and just kind of, you know, sorting it out. I'm excited to see Babylon again when it comes, I don't know, wherever it'll be, HBO Max or something like that, because I'm sure there's a lot that I missed. It was a long film, but a good one. If I had to choose between the two, I would choose The Artist. That's just me. And or I'm not even putting Singing in the Rain in there, because you can't. But I loved talking about it with you.
Love it. Yeah, I definitely had a great time. Like I said, I was a huge fan of Babylon, and it's a love and seeing the comparisons between The Artist and your admiration for it. I'm just curious, what are a couple other, maybe before we sign out, some of your other favorite like silent films that you can think of that like just really have stuck out with you, like kind of over the years, kind of like what comes to your mind first in that era? Wow. We've obviously covered one on the podcast with Haxan, which I loved watching.
Yeah, Hackson was one of my favorites because a lot of those like early silent films are kind of scary to me. So like, especially around Halloween when we did Hackson, I love that one so much. And it has just like such a creepier vibe because it's silent. Nosferatu, of course, is that way as well.
Nice.
And then, you know, Metropolis, which we just covered, was always one of my favorites. But I also, I'm trying to think, there was the Cecil B. DeMille film, which is so interesting and super long. The greatest story ever told, I believe it's called, about the Ten Commandments and God and everything. Really interesting. And then also the Phantom of the Opera, the silent version, is one of my favorites as well. Do you have some that come to mind, or is it, are you still exploring the silent?
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of, I don't know, it was never, you know, where I went to first. I've mentioned a couple of times, obviously, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I saw at a young age, and I've rewatched it a couple of times as an adult, and that one is crazy good. I definitely love that one the most. But yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the Cecil B. DeMille one. I definitely would like love to check that one out, but
yeah, they're all like a ton of them, of course, are on Criterion, and I have them in my list. So if you're cruising through there, you can go and check them out.
I'm doing that on a daily basis, taking advantage of that. So love it.
Yeah, for sure. All right, cool. Well, yeah, a bit of a mini episode, but at the same time, you know, pretty full too. I think we covered a lot. Babylon, go see it in theaters. Let us know what you thought. Let us know if you like the artist, if you like Singing in the Rain, and if you like silent films at all. Let us know in the comments wherever you follow us. We're on Instagram, Twitter. We're also on YouTube, which seems to be where we've been getting a little bit more traction lately. You get to see us on YouTube, but we're also on Spotify and all those places to hear it. And yeah, we love doing it. We'll be back next week with another installment of Remainders.
We'll be closing out our Fritz Lang double feature with your pick, M, which I'm very excited to revisit. So
me too. I actually haven't watched it in a little bit. So as soon as we get to talk about that, we'll close a little bit of our 2023 chapter on Fritz Lang and move on to some more exciting stuff that we got coming up.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.